must change my ways. Change my ways. Those evil. So I set out across that way to strike them down, to make them pay, and change their ways, their evil ways. But I can't.
Back. Top of the third hour. Today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast. It's Wednesday, October 9th, 2019. I want to read the Market Security State section from Patrick Porter's Soldiers Fighting Alone, The Wars of the Market Security State. Especially that section, which, by the way, is followed by the section titled Shopping for Victory. Another interesting little bit, but I also wanted to include that clip of FCC Chair Tom Wheeler back at the National Press Club in 2016, June 2016. That clip, you know, where he says the big game changer is that 5G will use much higher frequency bands than previously thought viable for mobile broadband and other applications. Such millimeter wave signals have physical properties that are both a limitation and a strength. Blah 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 blah. You mean the military technology, Tom Wheeler? That technology? Okay. And, you know, then he talked about, you know, on the network side, Verizon and AT&T tell us they will begin deploying 5G trials in 2017. People don't even realize this stuff was rolling out. You know, you look at your the wireless routers that you've had for years, and your look at the whatchamacallit, move it now. Look at your network connection and see what it says. You mean I've had 5G hardware for years? Mm-hmm. These efforts will, of course, help inform the standards and process by putting stakes in the ground. More stakes. And the first commercial deployments at scale are expected in 2020. We've been hearing about it, but we're behind. Really, the propaganda is behind, you know, and people are just not too many people concerned about the health effects and things. This timeline requires that we act to pave the way today, he said. With the new rules I am proposing in our Spectrum Frontiers order, take our most significant step yet down the path of our 5G future. And he talked about, you know, the $1 trillion, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. Anyway, maybe we can play that clip, but we'll get back to that. So, without further ado, let's go to the phones first. William in Montana, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Morning, Chris.
Morning, William.
It's I think it's very interesting when we talk about the shrinking opportunities to unplug. You would think that if you were up in the yak, at least you would have the opportunity to unplug.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you may not be able to expect a lot, considering what has happened in our culture. But at least you should be able to shut your door and not have the intrusion of electronic media, which mm-hmm. not only delivers, but it takes. You know, it's not just the delivery system of information. It's a surveillance system. And, you know, we're, you know, we have long passed the final stages of being in a total surveillance society. You know, this was supposed to be prevented by the Fourth Amendment. You know, protections to, you know, unreasonable searches and seizures, and and you know, even if you most people, I think many people in this country have never even read the Fourth Amendment. You know, because it outlines quite of interesting things. You know, it says that, you know, even if the judicial system, the judge or the magistrate or the sheriff, you know, they can't just decide to search. You know, that was under the Fourth Amendment. It was like, you know, you had to have probable cause. Mm-hmm. And you know, when someone came up and said, well, I think this is necessary for public safety, it had to be supported by oath or affirmation. You know, this wasn't just hearsay or someone saying, I really think you should look into their business. You know, it had to be more grounded in that. And it had to be extremely specific. You know, it not only had to outline, you know, the persons and things to be seized, you know, they had to be very specific. This wasn't just data mining or, you know, let's go in and see what we can find. And so it's very interesting when you mention the Yak. You know, I being from Montana, I know about the Yak. Many people don't have a good idea of what the Yak is. And 9 years ago, or 10 years ago, I guess,
speaking of that, yes. I mean, just so people know, basically you drive up bad roads on either side. You can get to it from a couple of different ways.
Sure.
You know, really, I guess three ways, but in any direction you come to or from, you come to it on bad roads, and it's literally two bars and a gas pump, and, you know, that's about it. That's the Yak.
It's interesting that, you know, about 10 years ago, I woke up in a sweat, and I realized it was time for me to get out of Portland, Oregon. Which when I got there like 30 years before was really a sweet place, and and you know, we were thinking about getting out, and so we thought, hey, well, why don't we go up the gorge? You know, Hood River's a nice place, or maybe up into the high country, the high desert up by Bend. And that night when I woke up, I said, we have to get a lot farther away from the West Coast than Hood River. And so because I'm a geographer and a map maker and I know a lot about geographic information systems, I put those skills to work, and I started saying, well, this next time when I leave here and go someplace, I want to know where I'm going to land. And so I did an extensive search, not only of the Internet, but I pored over maps. And I used a lot of remote sensing data just because I had it available to me. And, you know, I kept eliminating. There's a process in the geographic information systems where you do a lot of overlays, and you try to identify those places that have all the qualities you're looking for, or those places that have all the qualities you're not looking for. And you start getting these little islands, you know, on your map. Because you might say, well, I want to be so far away from a highway, but I want to be so close to a university, but I want to be so far away from, you know, avalanche danger or volcanic activity or nuclear power plants. And you go through this complex thing, and you get these little tiny islands appearing on your map of those tiny places that meet all these criteria, either for good or for bad. And when I did this process, you know, which is, you know, was part of my job, so it was something that only took me a month or so. The Yak appeared in one of these islands. I didn't know what the Yak was, and so I started looking for the, you know, information about the Yak. This was 10 years ago when the Yak back then, I think, was like 64 people, or, you know, It was even tinier. It was basically just a gas station and a little place where people met for, you know, lunch and music fest, you know, on the weekends. I mean, it's tiny, tiny, tiny. But it really stroked my interest, and I started, you know, looking into it more and more. And then I realized that, you know, that was way out in the boonies. And I didn't particularly want to be that far out, but it was interesting that the Yak was one of these places that appeared. But it was also interesting some of these other places in the country and in the West. Mostly I was looking at the West. But another place that sort of appeared was Crestone, Colorado. And I was like, well, that's interesting. I want to know more about Crestone. And then there was also a place in Vermont. And I thought, and they were tiny islands. And I thought, why do these places, they're pretty far distant from each other, why did these places appear? And it was interesting. It was going to take me another decade to find out why. There were very interesting things that were happening that sort of bound these places together. And you mentioned the Club of Rome, and, you know, one of their big things, you know, and they've been very active. It wasn't just they're not a thing of the past. And one of the things that they're very active in doing is redefining what prosperity means. And a part of this is the rewilding of the world. And what they said was that one of the problems about rural people is that it's very difficult to deliver them all the benefits of technology because of how diffuse they are. And so wouldn't it be wonderful to find ways to encourage them to sort of come into the family of man? You know, come on into these megalopolis. You'll find that with our new design, we have learned how to make these places a paradise. Plus, you have great opportunities for new community. And why should just the wealthy city dwellers benefit from all of this technology and all of this wonderment? You know, and so all we have to do is, it's not like we're trying to move you out of this place. We're trying to show you that new opportunities await. Yeah. And when I looked into this, I had like three or four friends who were diffuse across the North America. And it was interesting that they were all, you know, kind of environmentalists, and they were people that wanted to get away from it all. And it was interesting that all three of them over this 10-year period were approached by whatever under different names, Nature Conservancy. You know, and they were all approached. This other couple were GIS consultants too. They were environmentalists, and they were also ecologists. And they were approached by organizations. And it was interesting that two of these organizations was related to Lawrence Rockefeller. But they were also, the spin was, we have watched your work and we see your sincerity, and what we want to do is give you the means to help create a better world and to preserve what we have. And it was interesting that this, you know, these three people that I knew, they all got approached within that 10 years. And, you know, one person was in Crestone, Colorado, and that was the, you know, the place where Maurice Strong, you know, made his big pitch, you know, to create the new Rome. And another one was in upstate Vermont. And they also got pitched, and it all made perfect sense. And it was also very seductive when someone, you know, with money and position and financial backing came up to you and said, we've watched you, and you have fought the good fight, and you deserve support. And it's just like the woman in the Yak. You know, that is a very difficult thing to turn your back on. If you believe that she's just not fully aware, let's say.
Right.
That it's not more sinister than that. And I have a tendency, from what I've learned over the last 10 years, to believe that the whole rap that is given to these people basically is a little bit more involved than, you know, surfaces. You know, they're basically told that, well, we know more than you do, and we want to tell you that in order to attain your goal of peace and prosperity for all beings, including the animal beings, you have to make some hard choices. We don't want to tell people about this. You have to understand that people are very sensitive and about their individual freedoms, but we have to make hard choices in order to maintain these things. And these people, I watched these three people that I knew fall for this. You know, and it was like, how would you like to go to Patagonia and protect the wilderness? We need to explain to the Argentinians and the Chileans that this Patagonia is a precious opportunity. It's a precious thing. It doesn't just belong to the nation states. You have to understand this belongs to the citizens of the world. And what's really interesting, and I had this thought while you were talking today, is that in all three of these places, Patagonia, Crestone, Colorado, and in this place in Vermont, and also in some ways in the Yak, one thing that a GIS guy would notice is that what did all four of these places have in common? Not so obvious. They were all very pristine aquifers.
I was hoping you were getting to all of that. I was hoping you were getting to that because riparian rights was,
And that is like, you know, you wouldn't notice that, and they wouldn't talk about that. But when these people, the Club of Rome and the Maurice Strong people, the people, Lawrence Rockefeller and people like that, the one thing that they have on their table and have had on their table for the last 30, 40, 50 years, is water is going to be key. And you can't have that water locked up if you have people, local, out in these rural areas, thinking that they have rights to it, you know, or thinking that they have rights to keep you from developing it. Mm-hmm. And so if you look into this, there's no substitute for knowing a lot of history. There's no substitute for digging deep into these things, because you might be saying, well, what she really wants to do is protect the elk and the grizzlies so they can roam wherever they want to.
Right.
And you'll find that the people who are calling the shots behind the scenes, which isn't so difficult to discover, it's just very difficult, you know, who do you call after you discover it? I mean, who would listen?
Exactly.
Who would know what the significance of it was?
Yep. So, to just sort of round out that discussion, particularly of this area, Montana Senator Mike Cuff has for years been pressing to have Lincoln County and Libby, specifically Lincoln County, Montana, but the Libby area in particular, sort of reimbursed for the power that is distributed out across the country, particularly out to the states further west of the Libby Dam. And he has said, you know, based on the, well, I'll finish that point and we'll finish fleshing this out. To your point about what I would categorize as riparian rights, when we come back, folks, stick around. We'll be right back.
Hi, Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
The reviews for Extendivite are amazing. Here are some from Amazon. By Christine, great for heart palpitations. By Anne, before I started using this product, every afternoon, my ankles and my hands would be swollen. That doesn't happen anymore. So if that part of their advertising is true, I have to assume that the rest of it is also. Not to mention that when I had my yearly blood test, only a few weeks after beginning to use this product, my cholesterol had dropped over 30 points. I'm going to continue to take it. By Croc, I love this product. It really works. By Brad, works great. Thank you. Tell us your story. Get your Extendivite today. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822. Or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Welcome back. So, speaking of the issue of riparian rights, water rights, and I'm glad you touched on that. I was hoping and thinking you were headed that direction, at least in part. And so, speaking of that, you know, folks should look into the watershed of the Crown of the Continent, for example, and see how important that area is. And like you said, you know, you start looking into these little pockets. And it's also interesting, just as a side note, you mentioned Crestone, Colorado. In the Netflix series The Ranch, it's set in a fictional at this point anyway, town of Garrison, Colorado, which is it's actually a neighboring area. And it's just interesting, right, the propaganda that's come out in that series, sort of trying to represent these sorts of areas. And what's happening is this Newman's Hill large corporate influence is coming in, and it's clearly corrupt and gobbling up the town, and water is an issue in the latest season. And it's just interesting, the propaganda that's being rolled out to America. Anyway, Montana Senator Mike Cuffs has tried to get essentially a rebate of the power based on the land that was flooded as a result of the creation of the Libby Dam. And he has said that it should be about $30 to $40 million a year that's rebated to the Lincoln County area because of that land. And that is an issue that has surprisingly little traction in the area. And I don't think I've found, I've asked numerous folks, including city council members, people don't know about it. So that's interesting, speaking of water rights. But also, it's interesting, the area that we're talking about is, you know, it was destroyed, or it has been rocked significantly by the departure of the natural resources industry, particularly mining and timber. But there was also Grace, the Grace mine in particular, and that scandal, which created the, you know, perception of toxicity, and that resulted in a Superfund site. And so a community that was very proud of its natural resource, you know, working class folks. I mean, there were signs. I remember growing up in the 80s and 90s, you know, this house is supported by timber dollars, for example, and they'd have bumper stickers and stuff, and you see logging trucks all over the place. You don't see that much anymore. And so you take that away, the town starts to become anemic economically, the area. And then you bring in the Superfund, you get them hooked on the public dole. And then you see articles like this recent one, feds prepare to hand off control of Libby Superfund to state. And these people, the Superfund leadership, has been telling the local community for the past few years now, you guys need to be prepared, because, I mean, it's like $11 million a year that's going to evaporate from the community. So what are you going to do now? And what I think is particularly interesting in terms of timing, speaking of the water issue, is now that we're going to do that, and to me, that's, I think of RAND Corporation nation building on a smaller scale. You know, you have to, first you get them to failed state status, and then you can say, oh, we need to come in and do something. So now that they're economically crippled, the feds are going to hand control of Libby Superfund over to the state. And what comes next, but right on the heels of this also, is now the selenium problem. Now we're hearing that, you know, there are massive levels of selenium concerning the same bodies of water. And so now selenium contamination is a huge issue in the same area and the same bodies of water. Imagine that.
It's interesting that, you know, if you go and dwell on these individual issues, it's very surprising how these same things appear in all three of these places that I've watched. You know, in Patagonia, which is way down at the southern tip of South America, I had a friend who was very much into mapping and ecology and saving the whales and all this stuff. And he went down there he was very sincere, very hard worker. He worked very hard. He lived in rural Washington, really skimped and saved so that he could do this. And he was absorbed by these grants. And when someone comes to you and starts telling you that what they want to support you to do is to keep this wild resource for the world and for the children and for the grandchildren, it's very subductive, and you will hear some of the same verbiage when you get into Crestone. Because one of the things that happened in Crestone was Maurice Strong bought, you know, 250,000 acres of land on a whim, because his new wife wanted to have a sanctuary where apparently some Native American Indian told her that she was going to create the new Rome where all religions of the world could come and feel safe. And supposedly that's what Marie Strong was doing this for, was to give his new wife this opportunity to save the religions of the world, where so everyone could come in an ecumenical paradise and live happily ever. But it was interesting, if you dig a little bit deeper, who did Marie Strong buy this land from? He bought it from Anand Khashoggi, one of the biggest arms dealers in history, from Saudi Arabia. And why did he buy? How did he get a hold of this? Well, he sent his minions out to find the biggest occluded aquifer in North America. Now, an occluded aquifer, you know, there's aquifers all over the place, but an occluded aquifer is where stuff from the surface can't get down to pollute the aquifer underneath. Now, if you were to be some, far-reaching, future-thinking person, and you could think of all the terrible scenarios that could befall North America, it might be extremely valuable to have an occluded aquifer, because if something really nasty happened on the surface, water was going to be more precious than gold, and especially if you could avoid contamination. And so here is this arms dealer, one of the largest arms dealer in Middle East history, and he came and bought up this large place in Colorado. Why? Because he loved the wild out west? No. He knew that beneath this was an aquifer that was so great that it would supply water that was not contaminated by fill in the blank, agricultural chemicals, radiation, whatever. And so when you start thinking about somebody doing something like this, I mean, the local surface issues sort of pale in comparison. And Marie Strong couldn't help himself. He said he didn't know that. He said, I didn't know that. And he tried to join up with about four or five guys who had, if you sort of checked out their lineages, they were related or associated with Lawrence Rockefeller, with a whole bunch of what you call, bad guys. And they were going to sell this weather. They were going to make a little money on the side. They knew that this was going to be for future use. It was going to be fabulously wealthy or worthwhile. But they wanted to maybe make a little money on the side and sell the water to Denver. And when it was discovered, when all this stuff, Marie Strong hightailed it to Beijing. He left. He pulled up stakes. His new age wife is still there managing the Manitou Institute, which has all these high-minded things. And who is one of the principal, or who was one of the principal supporters, financial supporters? Lawrence Rockefeller. They were heavily into that. And when I knew two people that lived in Crestone, and they were associated with this religious group, and they said there was very interesting things that happened. This group, everybody's skimped and saved. Everyone worked real hard. They were paid nothing. They were all religious, devotees. But every now and then, these three or four black limos would come up this road into Crestone. And Crestone is almost as isolated as the Yak. And all these people would get out and go to this, special auditorium, which no one was allowed to enter. And, this woman saying, I don't know who were those people? And I just sort of slapped my head, like, who were those people? Well, it's a long story, honey. I don't know whether I have time to go into it. But, when you start looking into these things, you start finding out that one of the issues that they try to convince people in the Patagonia that this is not a good place to be. You're really missing out on a lot of opportunities. And we will be willing, and our motivation is only to protect the wildlife, we would be willing to relieve you of this land for a reasonable price, in one of these megalopolises where you will have many, many more opportunities and broadband like you would not believe.
Multi-use. You can live upstairs and work downstairs. It's going to be a paradise.
And the neighbors and the music, you know, and the video and the plays, you know, the culture. I mean, this is the spiel. It's slightly modified based on national values and things, but it's basically the spiel that's being given in the Patagonia of saying, look, there are very wealthy people, benefactors that would love to turn this into a pristine wilderness preserved for the future, and you could actually clean up on this if you would be willing to just move or relinquish your idea that some local state like Argentina or Chile really has any rights to this. I mean, it's such. But if you look down underneath, what is another thing? It is a occluded aquifer, one of the largest in the world. And so this idea of benefiting the alpacas or the llamas or all the little tiger lizards that are, you know, endangered, I mean, that's just hogwash. It really is hogwash.
Yep. And you can see that. That was kind of what I was trying to point out in the obvious paradox and conflict of interest in the Yaak Valley Forest Council meets high-speed internet.
So that the grizzly bears can have internet. I mean, I saw this in Northern California too, where these people were back to the land, and they got back to the land, and they found this place, this corner in Northern California, up by Shasta, but more out on the coast, and you couldn't even get in and out of this place, you know, in the wintertime, because the heavy rains would turn the. You couldn't even use four-wheel drives to get in on these roads. And one of the things that these back-to-the-land people started complaining about was opportunities for their children, you know. And just in the last 4 or 5 years, there was a big push down there in this area of saying we must have high-speed internet because the children have to have. I mean, if my daughter can't learn how to multitask with her high, you know, intelligent smartphone, she's going to be greatly limited, and I won't stand for that. And so here is another, you know, drive to say we need broadband in this place that still is a wilderness and a wonderland. If you do not, from the inside, start demanding that this surveillance thing—I mean, this has nothing to do. This whole concept of, you know, the total surveillance society, I mean, it is based on broadband. And this, and when you talk about G5, I mean, they're selling that by saying, you know what, we could put this on a pole, you know, out in the boonies, and you will have better internet than they have in Eugene or in Portland or in Seattle. And so how good is that? You know, and we don't need to have all these, you know, copper wires coming in over the mountains. We just need to have this thing on a pole. Just maybe we'll put it right down by the elementary school. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Speaking of that, I think it's probably a moment for two things, segue to two things. With all of this technology, I have been, you know, I mentioned yesterday wanting to do something about that. And back when Dave Stetzer was on in March, on March 20th, I think I was looking at the description in the archives yesterday. I think it was fantastic. Everyone should listen to that March 20th broadcast with Dave Stetzer on. But I talked to Dave earlier today and sort of revisited the plans that I had intended to make. And, you know, what he says, there are three things you need to worry about or consider: the wires, the space, what he calls space, Wi-Fi, cell phones, all that stuff, all the wireless stuff, and then ground current. I think it's a moment where all of these things could coalesce and we could start to really shine a bright light on all of this stuff. You know, what's been said about 5G, the secret, not so secret rollout of it, the harmful effects of all of this technology, the way that things like the 1996 Telecommunications Act have brought us to the point where, as people like Dana Ashley have pointed out, you can't even challenge this stuff on the grounds of health concerns. You have to challenge it on aesthetics. And, you know, I've talked about the articles down in Florida, for example, where the Trump people say, well, it's an eyesore, so we shouldn't do this. And you think, why? You know, but the article talks about health risks and concerns. But why did they challenge on aesthetic lines? Well, because that's the only way you can challenge now, is technology. And so I think it's just a moment where you could really get some traction and have people see with their own eyes, with the testing equipment, for example, look at all of this harmful radiation, including, Dave was telling me this morning, you can also use certain of the meters to test current that's going through a person's body. And it's just shocking. You can see one of the links that I included in that broadcast archive was effects of stray voltage on livestock, which was a video that they published based on research. I mean, this was back in August of 1999. And they made a video of the effects of stray voltage on livestock, and they documented it. What happens? Dr. Magda Havas has done some work, and some other folks have too. But I mean, this is you can see videos like this. You can test and see the voltage that's going through, the current that's going through your own body, and I can't imagine that people see this and wouldn't be concerned.
I have one of those meters that, and one of the things that when I was very much interested in the smart meters outside your house, we have one. I live in, not what would we call real rural Montana, but we have smart meters, and I for a while there I was interested in showing people what the results of these things are, and so I had continuous monitoring of this thing. And one of the interesting things that happens is every once in a while, you would say, well, I can put one of these tri-field meters up and I can show you in different parts of the house, especially over in the utility room, right where the smart meter is on the outside. I can show you how high it gets. It's higher than you should have exposure to. But every once in a while, since I had this tracking meter that logged all this stuff, every once in a while, for about 3 or 4 minutes, and it usually happened in the night, 2-3 a.m., this thing would go off the charts by literally dozens of magnitude. And I'm thinking, like, hey, if this is a reporting meter that sort of just reports my usage, why does this thing go through the roof in irradiating, a 30-foot, 40-foot in diameter hemisphere? What is that about?
Which that reminds me.
It doesn't. Yeah.
Well, so we had the weird fires and the PG&E stuff in recent years down in California in particular. Reminds me of the ABC 30 Action News segment. Lawsuits claim faulty PG&E smart meters started house fires. Mm-hmm. I'll play that clip. Anyway.
And I've also done some research, up in Wisconsin. It's a big dairy industry.
Yeah.
And they found out that these transient voltages that were in the ground would really have a big economic effect immediately, because when you have these milking machines on the udders of cows, you can see a 20-30% drop when these stray transients were high. And so in Wisconsin, they have very strict rules about where the utility companies put this stuff. You know, like on every pole, you'll see in the rural areas, you'll see a line coming down off the pole. It's to protect the pole from lightning, and also to have some way to drain off these transients. That happens when there's microwave increases, result of sun energy, blah blah blah, whatever the case. And what happens is in the cities, they used to have one on every pole, but now they don't because of the grid is so complex, it's so concentrated that the utility companies found out, like, hey, you only have to put one of these lines going down to ground, let's say every 10 poles. And if your house happens to be on one of those poles, near one of those poles where the line comes down, you might get, 10 orders of magnitude more in quotes stray transients in your area. And if you're sitting in a metal bathtub and if you have one of these meters on your finger, you'll find that you're getting about 100 to 1,000 times more of this stuff than your neighbor or at least the guy, four doors down. And so those are the type of things that, and if you try to go in and find out about this, if you go to PG&E or you go to one of these electrical companies, and you say, just for educational purposes, I was wondering if you could tell me more about these, you will get, wait right here.
Yeah,
and somebody will come out and read
and
you
escort
the riot,
you out of the
riot
building.
Act. Yeah. And it's like, and these are places where there's nothing but smiles for customers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I mean, they will show you everything. They will give you brochures. They will, support your kids in their science projects and all this. But boy, if you bring up that subject, you become a pariah instantly, and you're no longer welcome there. So it's known, and it's highly political. And it's only going to get worse, so it's very good for us to educate ourselves about these things. But again, it becomes so technical, and who do you call? Who will listen?
Exactly. Yep. And the is it voluntary compliance? That discussion arises as a public utility. What can you do about it? And so again, I think that I don't know. Maybe it's a moment where the timing is right. You start to alert people to this, and they get to the point that you just mentioned, and you start to see this is harmful, and they know it. So why is this happening? And you get a few people. I mean, in herdthink fashion, two people is a group. Three people, 5, 10, 12 people is a group. So, the individual at this point, which is where I was trying to get with Hayek's Road to Serfdom, the individual at this point is considered a pariah, generally speaking. And so one person walks in, but two people is a group. So if two people walk in, or 5 or 10 or whatever, then all of a sudden, I think that has a different mental connotation.
Yeah, I think we're quickly approaching. I think we're already there now, but I think there's a latency of understanding, how bad it is. But
I
will guarantee you that trying to get away will soon become illegal. This whole
Absolutely.
Thing of living off the grid, that's going to become illegal. There's going to be some...
I mean, illegal is strong language. Voluntary compliance is really, anyway.
Well, of course, if you care about the future and the children and
right.
the elk and the grizzlies, right. of course you will capitulate. But I will tell you that there is a lot of... concern, and they usually use like educational departments of saying, you living off the grid and you don't have internet, this is almost a type of child abuse,
right?
Because your children are going to be completely handicapped And we have a responsibility under state law to make sure that these kids don't lose the opportunities that are available for everyone. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, you know, homeschooling, that is a little, that's another form of child abuse. And we're only doing it to save the children or the grizzlies or the elk, which I can't remember right. what they told us to say.
Which is ironic, I think, because those folks who are saying those things should go look up what cluster B personality disorders are and see that that kind of thinking is precisely a psychological disorder.
They would turn to you, Chris, and say, how much are you offering? What type of grants are you giving for me to go and look up that information? Because I got someone over here that's offering me a bigger grant. To make sure that nobody gets homeschooled in the Yak.
My kidnapper has a bigger grant than your kidnapper, so, yeah.
Yeah. And absolutely. And, you know, I'm just amazed that, you know, how small a world it really is. You know, why did three people that I knew, who are very honest people, very decent people, good people, how did they get absorbed, you know, in Patagonia, yeah. in Crestone, in northern Vermont, and like I would say, like I do know a little more about the Yak than I let on, and I'll tell you, there are some, if you think that there's not a system of surveillance,
yeah.
and in the
Yak. The FBI beat you to your research project.
Right, and they basically, there's people there in the Yak, if you show up there, they will come to greet you. And they will love to know more about you. It's mm-hmm. just that type of community. We love to know about the people who have come mm-hmm. here. And maybe we could come over and interview you tonight.
Could you speak a little closer to this phone, this microphone here, please? Just a little closer.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, when I looked on YouTube, I found a couple series of YouTubes mm-hmm. done by this one gentleman. And he was just doing it to create community.
Sure.
And he went around interviewing these people, and two people in the Yak refused to be interviewed.
Yeah.
And this became a big issue. Mm-hmm. Later on, by happenstance, I ran into a woman who ran away from the Yak. She was a part of the Inner Sanctum, and she ran away from the Yak, and I turned to her, we were talking about something else, and I said, hey, have you ever heard of the Yak? And she almost fainted. It was like, you know, it was coming for her, you know, that she thought she had gotten away from it. And later on, when she finally accepted that, no, I didn't know that she had run away from the Yak, she told me a lot about the Yak. And about this sort of insidious mechanism for keeping track of who was there, what they thought, and what they were saying. And
yep.
and it's like, you know, it was under the guise of, we need to build community. And I'm
yeah.
just doing this so that I can tell your story. And when two or three of the people, two and especially, refused to be interviewed by this person, all types of weird things started happening. This
yep.
person started getting more aggressive about, what are you up to? You know, why don't you want to be honest with your fellow community, your members
yeah.
of your community? What are you hiding? And so it's not the beautiful little hideaway in the boonies, as it might appear on the surface. And when you think about that, you know, what good? I mean, whether it's 74 people or 200 people, what type of mechanism would finance going
exactly.
out and making a big deal about these people? I mean,
mm-hmm.
you have to understand, doesn't that sound strange to you?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, thanks a lot, Chris.
Thank you, William.
I appreciate what you're doing.
I appreciate your contribution. Thank you very much. Hey, before you go, one thing
yep.
that has also been mentioned, and just as a brief aside, what you're talking about, you know, all of that stuff in the yak, I think, you know, the gentleman to whom you're referring is probably the gentleman who bought one of the two establishments that, you know, his doesn't turn a profit, but that's okay because his child bride just had a modest but fairly sizable inheritance that he took it upon himself to disclose to the public. And so, you know, they're going to stay afloat. They'll be all right. Anyway.
Exactly. You definitely are talking about the same person I heard about.
So
all world,
one,
Chris.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing that I wanted to touch on at some point, there's been people have been asking more and more. I know that just in the last 2 or 3 years, every once in a while, somebody says something about a reading list or something like that. And so the concept of a reading list or an RBN library, as it has been referred.
Annotated bibliography and why this is important. That would be a very good thing to have available as a resource to some people, because this does require, I hate to break this to everyone, but you can't get to this skating on the surface. You will pull your hair out. Luckily, I don't have any hair left to pull out, but you can pull your hair out trying to say, is it them or is it me? Do I actually see this?
Yeah.
You know, does anyone see this? I mean, it seems obvious, but maybe I've just gone insane. I mean, that's the type of thing you get into, but you have to learn to get through that, and you have to learn to say, you know, you're not going to get there by skating on the surface. And we got to learn these things, Chris, so that we don't have to try to learn them every week. I mean, there's some things we just have to have under our belt. Or, you know, every week we keep chasing after these things and make a big issue out of things. And when you find out that, you know, why did the biggest arm dealers in the world buy the largest occluded aquifer in Colorado, and why did Maurice Strong buy it and pretend that he didn't know it was there? You know, those are questions you need to answer.
Well, hopefully we can collaborate on something like that, because, you know, that's been part of the discussion. People say, you know, that they would love to have your involvement in that annotated bibliography, and like you said, why it's important. I completely agree with everything that you said, and you know, what a great, I know that people have done different things similar, but I hope that we can collaborate on something like that. I think everyone would benefit.
Yeah, good luck to you, man.
Thank you very much. Much appreciated. Skip in California, I apologize that we missed you. It was important, you know, firsthand information we covered. So, you know, long form content sometimes does that. My apologies to the audience. I hope it was informative. As always, it truly is an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. We'll catch you on the other side.
Okay, nurse, let's get this man to the ER stat.
Right away, doctor.
We see this every day. Heart attack or angina pain due to blocked and clogged arteries. Chelation can remove obstructions or blockages from arteries and help avoid painful and expensive surgery. Now there's Angioprim. It's a liquid oral chelation product that you take with juice. You start to feel the results fast. Angioprim increases blood flow all over the body, and that means more energy and strength to take on the day with less aches and pains. 60 years of research has gone into chelation, and Angioprim is the result, a safe and easy way to unblock your veins and arteries from buildup that slow circulation.
Paging Dr. Jones, please report to the emergency room right away.
Log on now to angioprim.com. That's Angioprim.com. Or to speak with a trained consultant, give Angioprim a call at 954-882-7221. That's 954-882-7221.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.